Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Coming up on Tuesday, that is the 17th of June, it is an important event sponsored by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Continuing Education, Trauma in Our Community. And the subtitle of the event, if I understand correctly, Reimagining Solutions for Healing. And through the course of the day on Tuesday, a wide array of different experts in the field of trauma, as that plays out in so many different ways, we'll be offering thoughts on innovative ways in which we can seek to deal with trauma that people have experienced in one way or another. As I looked over the schedule of Tuesday's event, which looks really outstanding and intriguing from top to bottom, start to finish, one that leapt out at me as especially interesting was something that involved domestic violence and the possibility of using restorative practices to deal with domestic violence and the damage that it does, the trauma that, of course, it causes. And there is a pilot program underway or about to be underway. We'll find out more about that at the Sojourner Family Peace Center, which is Wisconsin's largest service provider for families who have been impacted by domestic violence. And we have two staff members from Sojourner Family Peace Center with us today, Ray Bruins and Marlisa Quiles Espinosa. And we also have with us Judge Mary Trigiano, who is a director and clinical professor of the Andrew Center for Restorative Justice at the Marquette University Law School and a former Chief Justice for the Milwaukee County Circuit Court. And we will be finding out from all three of our guests about the impact of domestic violence, especially in Milwaukee, and the need there is to try to find innovative ways to deal with domestic violence, to try to prevent it, and to deal with its painful aftermath, and then talk specifically about the way in which restorative practices might very well be a very helpful addition to the mix in terms of our response to domestic violence. Ray Bruins, Marlisa Quiles Espinosa, and Judge Mary Trigiano, we welcome all three of you to the morning show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm honored to speak with all three of you. Judge Mary Trigiano, I would like to begin with you since you obviously teach about restorative justice and have cared about this for quite some time. Maybe even ahead of you explaining what restorative justice is and restorative practices, maybe we could find out from you a little bit about your professional career and at what point both domestic violence and then especially restorative practices became of such great interest to you.
Yeah, that's a great question. And thank you for having us. So I had been a judge for almost 20 years. Before coming to the law school to direct the Andrew Center for Restorative Justice. And very early on in my judicial career, I had the opportunity to join then former Chief Justice Jeanine Geske at the Green Bay Correctional Center, where she was facilitating what we call restorative justice dialogues with those men who were incarcerated, as well as individuals who had been impacted by significant violent crime come and share their stories with these men. And I sat in that circle for 3 days. And like many people who have sat in those circles, I really saw restorative justice as a really unique and deeply human approach to addressing harm. That really resonated with me as a judge, and also allowed me to take some of those things that I learned in those circles with me on my path throughout my judicial career. And so it was somewhat of a natural fit, I think, for me at the end of my judicial career and when this position opened up to say, hey, this is something I want to do full time and take all my experience, my lived experience in the courts, as well as using restorative practices to the law school to teach our next generation of leaders, our Marquette law students. And so, yeah, it was a life-changing experience. I utilized some restorative principles throughout my judicial career, somewhat in the domestic violence courts, which I became very familiar with, spending about almost 4 years in those courts, and also having a significant relationship with Sojourner Family Peace Center and the work that we did in the courts, as well as trying to increase safety in our community.
Pretty good. You said a lot that I want to respond to, but one of them is I had no idea. I think a lot of our listeners will probably join me in having no idea that there are particular courts, in a sense, earmarked for domestic violence. Is that what you were saying?
Yes. Before I became a judge, there were Sojourner Family Peace Center, actually, leadership there, the executive director, Carmen Petrie, some of the judges and others in community worked at creating specialty courts that addressed intimate partner violence. And we have three specialty domestic violence courts where judges spend anywhere from 3 to 4 years in these courts addressing domestic violence and working with individual men who have harmed, trying to keep victims safe, and trying to support families in that endeavor. So those courts have been around for over 20 years now. And we rely on advocacy groups like Sojourner Family Peace Center to help support those courts in the work that we do.
Wow. So I think you already very much hinted at, but let's really allow you a chance to flesh out a full definition of what we mean by restorative justice and restorative practices, and then we will delve into the specifics of what that means when we are in the arena of domestic violence. But first, in more general terms, what are we talking about with restorative justice?
Yeah, so that's the first day of my class when I teach the restorative justice workshop here. What is restorative justice? Everyone wants to know. And it takes us almost a full semester to sort of flesh out what it is, because it's not a program, it's not a project, although we sometimes designate our restorative justice work as projects, but it is a philosophy, it's a way of being, and how we look through a different lens than the traditional system of justice. So I can give you sort of a sentence and then we can put some meat on the bones, right? Mm-hmm. So I would say restorative justice practices are structured, facilitated processes that bring together those who've harmed and those who've been harmed when safe and appropriate. I always add that because there's a process to this, for dialogue, accountability, and healing, right? And when have you ever heard the word healing used in the traditional justice system sense? You don't, but it's an important piece of where we try to sort of guide people to go when they've been harmed. One way to look at it is by comparing it to the traditional system of justice. So the traditional system usually asks three questions. Not always. There's a little bit more to the justice system than this, but it'll put it in perspective for you. The three questions are, what law was broken, who broke it, and how do we punish, or how do we hold that person accountable, right? The restorative justice framework shifts those questions into a more relational focus. So the questions are, who's been harmed, right? And in doing so, we really center and elevate the voices of victims or those who've been harmed in the process. The second question is, what is the harm? In the traditional system, we just look at the immediate harm that has occurred. Oh, you've been shot, your car has been stolen. You were beat by someone that you love, right? But we use storytelling to get to the harm and what we call ripples of harm. Ripples of harm is what happens when right? There's been a crime, a conflict, a challenge, and more people than just the individual person that's been the subject of the harm experience that harm. And then there's all sorts of trauma that can be associated. So we tell stories to tease out what those harms are. And the person who harms somebody has to listen to them. And then the third question is, how do we repair the harm, and whose obligation is it to do so? And when we ask that question, the person that has harmed somebody, the person who's been harmed, and community needs to take responsibility for that harm repair, right? In the traditional system, we pull people apart. You go to your corner, you go to your corner, you come out, right, fighting with your words. This restorative justice model brings people together to try to figure that out so everyone takes ownership in the harm repair and healing.
Right. Thank you for explaining that so clearly. So are we talking about one practice replacing the other in a particular case? I'm guessing not. I'm guessing that first system that you set out about, I'm not going to repeat it as well as I want to, but some law has been broken, who broke the law, and how should we hold them accountable, when we want to also bring in to bear this model of restorative justice, does that supplant that more traditional framework, or does that traditional framework still exist and this is, in a sense, placed on top of it or added to it?
Great question, Greg. The beauty of restorative justice is that it's flexible enough to come into play in all sorts of scenarios. It could be done before the traditional system comes into play. It could be done during, it could be done after, it could be done many, many years after, right? It could be exist alongside the traditional system, right? It could be an alternative in the right circumstances to the traditional system of justice. So the flexibility of a restorative justice practice is really important, especially in this project that we have going, where we want to try to figure out how we can repair harm and support families who are involved in intimate partner violence to become stronger. And I'm sure Marlisa and Ray can answer that as well.
Let me ask you just one more question that's really kind of focused on the courtroom. And again, this is kind of a visceral reaction that I am having. It's one that I know isn't true or entirely correct, and yet I have a feeling maybe others also hearing about this model of restorative justice might also have this same reaction. And that is to say that if we listen carelessly to what you have described, it sounds a little bit like that moment that occurs in some courtrooms at the moment of sentencing, when people who have been harmed have the opportunity to stand up and, in a sense, speak their piece, share their pain, sometimes in ways that are incredibly graphic, and sometimes those moments even erupt in violence right there in the courtroom as somebody, you know, screams at the person who has been convicted of the crime and who has done the harm and so on. And of course, once in a while, we as members of the community are privy to those kind of exchanges. And as you're describing restorative justice, it feels like it is a slight echo of that. But of course, it isn't at all the same thing, nor, I'm guessing, does it serve ultimately the same kind of purpose. Can you just help us compare those two things?
Sure. And I certainly spent a lot of time listening to people who've been harmed tell me about the ripples of harm they've experienced, about the deep trauma and pain and grief and suffering at the hands of somebody who's harmed them. And that can be very cathartic and important for people to share in a courtroom. But I often, when I interact with people who've been harmed outside that process and in the current restorative justice practice that we have, many people want answers to more of their questions. And you can't have that dialogue in a courtroom where a judge is sentencing someone who's harmed somebody, right? And victims of crime, victims of harm, people who've suffered, really appreciate sometimes, not always, not for everybody at all, right? They appreciate being able to sit across from the person who's harmed them or their loved one and ask questions that they can get their answers to that they can't in the justice system. What did my loved one say at the last moment of their last breath? Why did you do this at that point in time, right? There's so many questions they have swirling in their head. They don't get them answered in the traditional system of justice. But again, being able to tell your story in a court is important, and a lot of judges do allow that, and a lot of victims do show up, but many don't. So the courtroom can be frightening in that moment where you don't want to speak your truth or tell your story in a very sterile setting. We create a facilitated dialogue that can happen in different ways when it's safe. Hmm.
For those of you just joining us, we are speaking today on the morning show with three people who are going to be presenting at the event in Milwaukee, Trauma in Our Community, an annual event, at least partly under the auspices of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Continuing Education. Trauma in Our Community, Reimagining Solutions for Healing. One of the presentations talking about the possibility of restorative practices being brought to bear when it comes to painful instances of domestic abuse. And we've been hearing just now from Judge Mary Trujano, Director and Clinical Professor at the Andrews Center for Restorative Justice at the Marquette University Law School. Also with us, two staff members of the aforementioned Sojourner Family Peace Center, Ray Bruins and Marlisa Quiles Espinosa, who are also going to be participating in Tuesday's presentation. From either Rachel or Marlisa or both, I think it would be a good thing at this moment to hear just a little bit about the Sojourner Family Peace Center, when it was created, and for what very specific reasons, and the kind of services and resources that you offer to families who have been impacted by domestic violence.
Sure. Thanks for having us here.
This is Marlisa.
Marlisa, I can get us started. So as you mentioned, Sojourner is the largest nonprofit provider of domestic violence prevention and intervention services in Wisconsin. We serve nearly 10,000 clients each year. We were established in 1975. We're actually coming up on our 50th anniversary soon here. And we provide an array of support for, individuals and families affected by domestic violence, really focusing on safety and well-being and healing.
And tell us what your specific duties are as, I believe, Supervisor of Healing Services.
Sure, yeah. In healing services, again, we really focus on creating pathways to hope and healing for survivors of domestic violence and their children. So we support youth, adults, and families with things like support groups, and we do a lot of educational workshops and healing-centered workshops. Like, for instance, we recently had a sound bath. So we really try to present options in terms of different modalities for healing for folks and families, and survivors have their crisis needs met in our other programs at Sojourner, things like, immediate basic needs, food, shelter, housing, safety, and we're really able to focus on the healing journey and where the family or individual's at in that process.
Very good. Ray Bruins, what is your particular role at Sojourner Family Peace Center?
Yeah, so I'm the project manager of restorative practices and client engagement. So I'm very involved in the development of our restorative practices work and this pilot program, and also support survivors who are in a place in their journey where they want a more forward-facing role in our work and the movement. So I work with survivors who tell their stories to educate the community, to be in solidarity and support other survivors, and bring more of a face and a voice to this issue that still, for all the progress we've made, so often lives in the shadows. So they do great work, and I support folks with bringing that witness and that voice forward.
So in other words, it is up to somebody who has experienced this, who is a victim of this in a sense, that some, of course, regrettably don't seek help at all. Others do seek help, but prefer that it be, in a sense, a privately held pain. But there are others who have experienced this who feel like there is value in them sharing their story more widely, and in a sense, publicly. And it sounds like your work is to facilitate that. Is that right?
Yep, absolutely. So working with external partners who would love a survivor to speak at their event, media, things like that. And yeah, this is a group of survivors who are so passionate about doing everything they can to make sure this doesn't happen to another person, because they know what it feels like to feel like they're at a dead end and not know what to do, and to feel whatever they're feeling, shame, hopelessness, uncertainty. And, you know, it's one thing for me or Marlisa or our executive director, Carmen, to speak to survivors and say, oh, we've helped thousands of people on this journey. But it's another thing for a survivor who's been through our services, who's recently experienced this, to say, I have been through this and I've made it. And so I think they play a very important role in encouraging other survivors and building that bridge between folks who are disconnected and our work.
Right. The Sojourner Family Peace Center is located in Milwaukee. And so I know you are in the best position to talk about domestic violence, domestic abuse as it plays out in the city of Milwaukee. Whoever wants to take this question, how would you characterize, in a sense, the current state of domestic violence? How prevalent is it? Is this something on the rise? Is this something that is perhaps receding in any way? And also, is this something that we are talking about a bit more openly than was perhaps once the case?
Yeah, well, I think more openly than decades past, there's been a lot of great advocacy work. I think here are some important pieces about domestic violence. When we look at it nationwide, just starting there, over one in three women, about 35%, and then one in four men, 28%, have experienced either rape, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner in their lifetime. So those are really big numbers. And Milwaukee is no exception. And it's one of those issues that impacts folks from any walk of life, right? In any background, gender, race, economic situation, religion, et cetera. That's all true. And at the same time, there's certain demographic or experiential qualities that make it more, complicate it, right? So if folks are experiencing economic impact, poverty, cultural stigma related to domestic violence, limited access to resources, that compounds the issue. And so when we look at something like the poverty rate in Milwaukee being double the national average, it's 22% in the city, the national average is 11%, that impacts the situation in Milwaukee, because if you don't have the resources to move or hire a lawyer to help you in a custody case, that can make the situation far more difficult. So that's a big piece of this situation in Milwaukee. And of course, we're a diverse city, so we're working with clients of all different backgrounds, races. 5% of our clients, English is their second language. So we're trying to meet the needs of a variety of clients in culturally sensitive ways, having resources for translation so we can meet people from, you know, any background, any language. So that's a primary focus of our work at the Peace Center, is making sure that we are meeting folks wherever they're at and all the barriers that are there.
Well, of course, any domestic abuse is too much domestic abuse, but I am curious to know, to whatever extent, for instance, people reach out to you by just placing a phone call, is the phone ringing more or less now than perhaps it has, you know, in recent years? I mean, do you sense, or maybe even are you very specifically charting an escalating problem here? Or how would you characterize this in this way?
I mean, I think certainly, you know, like Ray said, domestic violence is an issue that there are added barriers. And so in Milwaukee, for instance, right, a lack of access to affordable and safe housing, right, we see that be a continuing issue. And so that exacerbates the issue of domestic violence if survivors don't have a safe place to go. And so I would say, yeah, you know, there are just added barriers and that create and intensify, you know, the issue.
So one thing I would add with that too is the impact of the pandemic. So yeah. During the pandemic, we saw our numbers go down, like our calls to our hotline, people walking in our building, but domestic violence wasn't going down, right? We know that it was going up because of all the challenges and being stuck at home and not being socially connected. So there are things like that happen like that that impact our numbers. And that's so trying to repair that and reach out and continue to be encouraging in our work, creating a text line so people have other ways of reaching out. So kind of doing everything we can to raise awareness and letting people know that we're here, because we want anyone who is experiencing this harm to have a bridge to whatever help and support, whether that's us, another org, community. It's all really important.
Yeah, that text line was added during COVID in response to, you know, a limited access to being able to call safely. And so our hotline and our text line are available for anyone to call or text 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
I'm so glad you said that, because that really points to how simplistic it is to think of, well, if the phone's not ringing, then the things must be okay or things must be better. And, of course, there are all kinds of ways in which people find themselves in situation where even something as simple as picking up the telephone and reaching out for help is just not possible for them to do. So thank you for clarifying that situation. Speaking of clarification, I'm finding myself, as we're talking, hearing the term related to abuse between intimate partners. And so, of course, between someone who is married or someone who is just intimately living with a partner or whatever. And I realize that when I am using the term domestic violence and domestic abuse, I'm also folding into the mix when children are the victims of unfortunate violence within their own homes. Is that something that actually is folded into this picture, and do we need to be careful about what we're talking about? Is that kind of piece, that child abuse piece, is that something quite distinct from, for instance, the work that you do? Does that often end up erupting in the midst of what otherwise this violence between partners is? I mean, where do we place that in this conversation?
That's a great question. So yeah, we support individuals and families experiencing domestic violence. So that's anyone that shares a home. And so intimate partner violence refers specifically to two folks in an intimate partner relationship, but we are really here to support individuals and families. And the issue of domestic violence certainly does have impacts on the children in the home, whether they're directly abused you know, witness to the violence. And so we have an array of services available for children and youth at the center as well.
And I'll also add an important piece, that the Sojourner Family Peace Center is a co-located model that we formed in 2015 with Children's Hospital. So we have a child advocacy center on site. And so they do forensic interviewing with children where there's been an allegation of abuse. So we're in partnership with them, in addition to the services we provide to support families where there's domestic violence in the home. So that's an important piece. And we have very skilled experts on site who are part of that network of care.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, we're talking with three persons who are working in the field of domestic violence, who are going to be presenting at the event Trauma in Our Community, under the auspices of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Continuing Education, a presentation on restorative practices in this field of domestic violence. And let's go no further without pinning down this matter of a pilot program. And first of all, is this a pilot program that is already underway or soon to be underway? And just what exactly does this pilot program involving restorative practices look like?
That's a great question. Yes, so it is a pilot program, a restorative practices pilot program through the Department of Justice Office on Violence Against Women. So we are one of 11 pilot sites, and we are in year one of our grant. And so we're really still in the planning phase of our project.
So at this point in time, in terms of the work that happens at Sojourner Family Peace Center, is there this piece involving restorative practice already in place? And would this pilot program involve some sort of expansion or transformation of those efforts? Or is this not yet part and parcel of what you do there at Sojourner?
I'm so glad you asked that, because it really builds on kind of what Ray talked about with her role earlier. We see it as a, you know, we see restorative practices as a natural progression of our work, of our current work. And so in the Healing Services program, we have our Voices Advisory Committee, which Ray spoke to, which is a group of survivors that, again, you know, give back and use their voices to speak about the issue of domestic violence. And so, you know, we've heard from them and other survivors that they really wanted just more options when it came to their healing and opportunities to heal and grow and thrive. And so that's part of the reason why we pursued this grant and this project.
Very good.
Hey, Greg, I would add, so this, I think, has been a long-term dream of Sojourner Family Peace Center, the executive director, and the past executive director of an organization called the Ullman Center, who worked with my predecessor, Justice Jeanine Geske, to, if you want to use the word pilot, restorative justice circles that brought together women who had been harmed by domestic violence, and men, not the ones that were intimately involved, but a group of men to talk about the harms that come from domestic violence, right? And so it was an attempt to try to use restorative practices to address men who batter. And I think they had some powerful conclusions from that, that there are models of restorative justice that can really work. And so not just building on that, but taking other kinds of restorative practices, victim offender dialogues, community conferencing, other restorative circles, and also integrating family units and community in that certainly is the next step to build on what they have been doing at Sojourner for many years.
Right. So if I understand correctly, what you were describing was a number of women who have been victims of this, and then a number of men who have been perpetrators of this, but not those connected with one another, in a sense, more generic groups and offering thoughts, and that would be one model of how restorative practices can do some good. I suspect that what we are mainly talking about today is the possibility of something more direct, in which perpetrator and target would be sitting down in some situation of dialogue. Is that right?
I think that's correct, and maybe even young teenagers who are victims of the parental dynamics, right? So that's, again, the beauty of restorative practices or restorative justice, is that you can take a look at the situation and trying to build a restorative dialogue around what's happening with the family unit and in community to help support creating healthier, safer communities and families that can parent. So yeah, taking it to the next level, seeing what can be done directly within families to help support them and to move into a safer, more healthier parenting situation.
I'm sure we're talking about a situation in which both people involved in this on either end must agree to be part of this, and I'm sure it would have little or no meaning if one or the other were, in a sense, forced to be part of this kind of dialogue. I assume this is a situation where both are willing participants. That being said, is any thought given, or is there any worry about the perpetrator and what their possible motivation might be willing to engage in this kind of dialogue? I mean, is the assumption made that that willingness is because of entirely laudable reasons, or would you acknowledge the possibility that sometimes that motivation might be something perhaps darker or self-serving in any way? And does the restorative justice framework, in a sense, allow for that or address that in any way?
Well, I would just start by saying that, yeah, our pilot and our program, as you know, we're building it, it's really survivor-centered. So it's completely up to survivors if this is, you know, an avenue for healing that they want to pursue, and it is completely driven by survivors. And so, as Mary said, some of them may be interested in a circle or restorative practice where they're engaging with someone who has caused harm, whether it be the person that directly caused them harm, or maybe more of a surrogate, a person who has caused harm to someone else. And part of that, part of the project and what we're looking at is a lot of pre-work and a lot of steps before something like that would happen, which, you know, Mary could also speak to. But, you know, survivors on our end would be engaged in a number of services for their own healing, and so would the person that has caused harm in terms of preparing them and I think discerning, you know, whether this is going to be a good fit for everyone involved.
I would say I learned three things by my predecessor that are really important that I pass on to my students at the law school every time, and that's preparation, right? You do it as much preparation as you can, and in this process, right, safety is absolutely paramount. Like, we do not want to put anybody in harm's way by doing these processes. So there's going to be a lot of work on the front end that the restorative justice process won't be subject to. It's going to be done by Sojourner Family Peace Center and other individuals. Then we start preparing them for a potential dialogue. And then there's more preparation involved. So we're very careful about putting each case, you know, each person, family, through a very rigorous screening process and preparation process. The grant specifically excludes certain people from participating, and, you know, we want to be mindful of that. So ongoing criminal proceedings is excluded. Those with a restraining order already in place are excluded. And so we're going to be mindful of those requirements, as well as the ones that we want to create for ourselves to make this process absolutely safe and authentic and truth-telling, right? You don't always know people's motives, but if you prep enough, if you ask the right questions, if you are really understanding the restorative justice process, you are thinking about that all the time as you build these facilitated dialogues.
Can you give us some idea of what that dialogue ultimately looks like or sounds like? I mean, once it is determined that, yes, this should go forward and everyone is willing and so on, or is it impossible to summarize? Does each one play out in entirely sort of unique fashion? Or is there, in a sense, a general structure or format that is followed? I mean, for instance, are there particular questions that are asked, or are there particular statements that tend to be made?
So yes and no to all your questions. Right? I always say each facilitated dialogue is really unique to the situation that presents itself, right? But there is a framework that we can use when we build our dialogue, or what we call our prompts, and we bring people into these groups. So we often use restorative justice circles that has been tried and true through generations, through indigenous practices across the world, right? And so when we bring in people into restorative justice circles,
we are asking certain prompts to focus on their own storytelling, their impact of their own harm and trauma. Everyone can answer the prompt, whether you've been harmed or harmed somebody. We do a lot of circles in correctional facilities where we tease out the harm and then we move into harm repair prompts. We often do what we call victim-offender dialogues. That is one-on-one, somebody who's harmed somebody and the person who's been harmed engaging in one-on-one facilitated dialogues. Always a facilitator, always a lot of preparation, right? And then there's other variations of facilitated dialogues, but again, very flexible process where we ask those three questions. Who's been harmed? What's the harm? And how do we repair and get to healing? A lot more involved in that, but that's sort of the framework and focus that we use.
I'm also curious about the what you said so forthrightly right at the outset, and I think Ray and Marlisa have essentially communicated the same thing, which is that nothing is more important than safety and security. And of course, that whole notion of safety and security has been so brutally violated, if not destroyed, in at least many of these instances. So what is done to make these exchanges utterly and perfectly safe, especially for someone who has experienced, been the victim of domestic violence? I mean, what exactly is done and or said to make this a completely safe environment for someone who is electing to participate?
You guys want to talk about what happens beforehand before we even start thinking of using a restorative justice dialogue?
Yeah, and again, I think as Mary said, safety is our priority for the survivor. And again, we're in year one of the planning phase, so a lot of the details of what the circles and things will look like we're still working on. But I think the built-in kind of exclusion criteria is a protective factor, but also these are folks, the survivors that we would be working with and essentially that would be expressing interest in circles are survivors who are engaged in our services and have actively engaged in things like safety planning and stuff like that. And they wouldn't be survivors that are actively in an unsafe situation, right? And so they're in a space where they're ready to have that dialogue and participate in the process. And again, not necessarily with someone who has directly caused them harm, but there would be, again, the pre-work and a lot of planning, as Mary said, that goes into it in terms of a safety plan and just ongoing support from both Ray and other staff that we would be hiring for the project. Hmm. And again, I want to point out that there are a variety of circles, and that is, again, kind of what is essential to the project, and that it's all about, you know, presenting more options and honoring the autonomy of survivors and what they want and creating their own path to healing for themselves, for their children, for families, you know, because ultimately, if survivors and their children can thrive, our communities can thrive, right? And I think for folks that have caused harm, you know, they don't exist in silos either. They exist in community. And so by helping harm doers and folks that have experienced harm, by helping everyone, right, we create safer communities and we can really interrupt that generational cycle of violence ultimately, right? That's the goal as well.
Greg, I also, the sort of the missing piece in this conversation here is the experience and expertise of Terry Strodhoff, Dr. Strodhoff, who has worked many, 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 many years helping men who have harmed to understand their own complex trauma, right, associated with this process. So we will have her expertise. Sojourner has expertise and experience in that as well. And so we will be all working together collaboratively to make sure that people are ready to actually dialogue together. And, you know, that's why we're part of this conference coming up, is because everybody
in that family constellation, including the community, can be impacted by deep and complex trauma related to the intimate partner violence, related to what's going on in their community. I think Marlisa said it before, there's housing needs, there's healthcare needs, there's, you know, all of those needs are sort of bundled up into this process where we have to do our best because, right, it is something we believe that is another tool for individuals to take advantage of to try to heal and repair harm.
I think one reason I was prompted to ask this question is because when you go on the website for Sojourner Family Peace Center, one of the first things we see is click here for help with assistance with restraining orders. And it just sort of underscores the fact that this is the landscape in which you are working. And it is a landscape in which sometimes it is about restraining orders and keeping people apart and doing all we can to keep people safe. And in a sense, what a brave step it is for anybody who has been touched by this to move beyond that necessity, and for many it is a necessity, an ongoing necessity, but the possibility of actually bringing some sense of restoration and healing is so powerful in and of itself. I appreciate...
I also think is we can't discount the fact that men and women who actually harm their loved ones, their family, actually want to heal as well, right? And I've done a lot of dialogues in correctional facilities where men who harm others, even in intimate partner violence settings, really want to move forward. They have children in common and they want to be able to safely co-parent. And so many men want, and women who harm, want to work on themselves to make things better. And certainly some don't. Or don't understand why they should. So it's not like we have people who are unwilling to come in. I think many of them do.
Well, it is fascinating to think about the ways in which this notion of restorative practices can be of tremendous help in this realm of domestic violence. And I'm sure many people are anxious to hear even more from the three of you in the presentation that you'll be making as part of this event on Tuesday, June 17th, Trauma in Our Community, Reimagining Solutions for Healing, that will be occurring in person in downtown Milwaukee, but also this is a conference in which people can participate virtually. And I want to thank all three of my guests on today's morning show, from the staff of Sojourner Family Peace Center, Ray Bruns and Marlisa Quiles Espinosa, and of course Judge Mary Trigiano, director and clinical professor at the Andrews Center for Restorative Justice at Marquette University Law School. My thanks to all three of you for this great work that you are doing and for being part of this conversation on the morning show. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much.
And if you would like information about tomorrow's event, Trauma in Our Community, sponsored by the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee School of Continuing Education, you can go to their website. So that would be uwm.edu/SCE. SCE stands for School of Continuing Education. And there you will find a link to conferences, and very quickly we'll find all the information you need for tomorrow's event, which is again called Trauma in Our Community. Tomorrow on the morning show, a lighter topic, that of model trains. This happens to be the 125th anniversary year of Lionel, the company most indelibly linked to the tradition of model trains. I'll speak to Roger Karp, responsible for a wonderful book called Lights, Camera, Lionel Trains, a photo history of an American icon. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today is going to be mostly sunny and also hot. We are headed for a high temperature today of 86 degrees. Overnight, partly cloudy. Slight chance of showers, a low of 63. Tomorrow, even warmer than today. Under partly sunny skies, we will have a 50% chance of rain with a high of 89 degrees. Rainy conditions are expected on Wednesday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.